Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, makers of specialty cheese from Switzerland, crafted with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmiusa.com. That's emmiusa.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt. I'm with Sean Randazzo, who's coming to us from Detroit. What's the official name? Detroit Pizza? Or you have a couple pizzerias. So what are the names?
Yeah, our main company is Detroit Style Pizza Company.
Detroit Style Pizza Company. And that's where a lot of you know Sean, maybe from buying equipment from him, because he's also, you know, one of the guys that really has supplied everybody around the country with the tools that they need to execute this style of pizza. But you also have some pizzerias as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, we have a concept in Royal Oak called Palazzo de Pizza. We also have a partner using the brand in Lake Orion, and we have Detroit Style Pizza Co. brand pizzeria in St. Clair Shores.
So, but are all the pizzerias under the banner of Detroit Style Pizza? Is that the sort of the brand name?
Well, the one in St. Clair Shores is the brand name is our Detroit Style Pizza Company brand, but the other one is Palazzo de Pizza. It's an Italian spin on authentic Detroit style pizza. So we got gelato, a bunch of Italian themed pizzas, you know, eggplant parmesan, chicken carbonara, some really good pizzas.
Well, that's cool. Well, thanks for being with us. And let me introduce also Jeff Smokovich, who's coming to us from Denver today at one of his two locations there. And of course, some of you also know him from his original sort of flagship Brown Dog Pizza in Telluride. And so, Jeff, thanks for joining us today. Where are you? Which location are you at?
I'm at our Congress Park location now, which is just a couple miles from downtown Denver.
Cool.
So I'm in the kitchen now, and it's only 8:30 in Denver, so behind me I have our par bakes, and they're all rising right now.
Well, today's episodes, and we're going to have two episodes with these guys today, and it's all about Detroit-style pizza. Jeff is in Denver, but he's at heart still a Detroit guy, right? You're born and raised in Detroit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yep. Yeah, I grew up right in the suburbs of Detroit in a town called Birmingham, and yeah, I was there, and I went to college there at the University of Michigan, and then a week after graduating, ended up in Colorado for a week or so, and 20 years later, still here.
did you end up in Colorado as a ski bum? Is that what drew you to Colorado?
Exactly, yeah. I came out here to ski. I grew up skiing in Michigan, hadn't been to Colorado skiing, and loved skiing in Michigan. And then when I came out here, I was just blown away by, you know, it takes a little bit longer than 10 seconds to get down a run.
Right.
Than in Michigan, you know, they're miles long here. So I decided to stay for the whole winter. And then ski bummed it for about 4 years and had five different jobs at a time just to kind of survive. And one of them was in a pizzeria.
Well, it's great when you're a ski bum to have some kind of a financial security blanket. And if it could be through pizza, all the better. You know, bring those two words together. That sounds like you found the right combo. And Sean, you stayed in Detroit. Did you guys know each other in Detroit?
We didn't in Detroit. We met probably after he was getting into, I don't know, Jeff, maybe you can answer, but it was a long time ago. I remember connecting with him. I don't know if it was the Hunt brothers from Via 313 that introduced us or vice versa, but it was many years ago. And, you know, me and the Hunt brothers, you know, we did a lot of talking before the style even really started, you know, spreading around and everything. But I forgot, Jeff, did I meet you through Zane and Brandon or?
Probably, I think so, yeah. Because it was around that same time, 10 or so years ago. And then we were doing probably in person, the first time we met was at Expo.
Yeah.
I think we were both competing. And I think that's the first time we met in person, but over the phone several times before that. And I would go into, when I would come back to Detroit, I went into Cloverleaf a few times. Maybe in Cloverleaf, actually, is what I meant. Yeah.
Were you working at Cloverleaf then, Sean?
Yeah, I was with Cloverleaf for 16 years before in 2012 is when we launched Detroit Style Pizza Company.
I see. Well, that's part of what we want to hear. We want to hear the story because you two guys are kind of the this generation's most probably visible and important brand ambassadors for Detroit Style Pizza. I mean, there's lots of spokes for the Detroit Style story and going way back to buddies and, you know, all these the 1940s and the blue pants and you're the ones who are carrying on that legacy at probably the highest level and helping other people, you know, and inspiring other people to get into it because it's now a national phenomenon. So I want to hear a little bit from each of you on what we'll do is in this first episode, we'll spend the time talking about your journeys in pizza and what brought us to the current moment. And then in part two, in the next episode, Jeff is going to walk us through his process. You're going to actually take a pizza all the way through and show us. And Sean is going to, because you guys have slightly different techniques or maybe some very different techniques that you each employ, since there's no only one way to do this. Sean will lob in a few questions and comments and we'll talk about how you guys do it and approach it differently. But we'll do that in the next episode. In this episode, I'd like to give each of you a chance to just talk a little bit about your story. We heard just a touch of Jeff's, Michigan to ski bum era, but we want to hear, a little bit more of that. But also, Sean, let me get back to you on this. A lot of people who are watching are probably, who don't know you, are probably wondering, why you're wearing the cap. And people who do know you know why, but if you could kind of bring everybody else up to date on how you're doing health-wise and what this is all about, so that we can sort of understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll address the elephant in the room. So what I'm wearing here is called an Optune cap. I'll bring it back before the new year. I was experiencing some symptoms, with my arm and some tingling and things like this. Went to the ER, had a scan. They let me go. Long story short, New Year's Eve. Oh.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I got interrupted by a call there. But New Year's Eve, December 27th, I was driving with my son and nephew in the car, and I started getting, on my left side, I started having like a little seizures. My arm was shaking, so I coasted into a parking lot, called 911. They rushed me to the hospital, and I'm leaving out a lot of details, but all I can say is there are so many variables that could have had me not here today. So I'm so grateful and blessed to be here. And as long as I'm here, I will continue to be grateful for everything. I was rushed to the hospital. They did a scan. It was 12:27. They found a tumor in my brain about a little bigger than an almond. And so they scheduled emergency brain surgery on New Year's Eve. And I am making this quick because there's so many different things that happened, but they, were able, I had an amazing surgeon, amazing staff working with me, and they were able to remove the entire tumor with good margins, meaning the surrounding area. It took about a month and a half to get biopsy results back from U of M, and it came back stage 4 glioblastoma, which is a super, I've heard rare, but common aggressive brain cancer that is no joke, really. So I immediately, once I found that out, was on radiation chemo treatment for 3 months, took a month off, had an MRI. Actually, between that time, I had another little seizure, and that was not a big deal, but so just to bring it up to pace, about a week and a half ago, I had an MRI. And then before that, I had one 6 weeks ago. And the swelling area, there was nothing found. So that's the most positive thing is as long as I can continue my scans with no cancer found, that's the ultimate goal here. But the swelling in the area was a concern. Last MRI, the swelling went down half the size. So we're really good shape there. All my lab results have always been very solid. I've changed not only lots of perspectives on life, I've completely changed my diet. I've lost 30 pounds since the new year. I'm in ketosthetics, so I'm doing the keto diet, basically because, cancer cells feed off of sugar and carbs. And, so I'm just trying to do whatever I can to, I have a beautiful family, 4 kids, I got to be here for them. I'm in my prime. It's not like I'm 70 looking back at, you know, everything I've accomplished. I'm just starting. Like, the next several years is like the time for me. So I don't plan on going nowhere. And, you know, the cool thing about this is, you know, just like everything, if you know me, I'm a very optimistic, very positive, not fluffy, realistic, but person. And I think that is 50% of everything when you're dealing with cancer, is everything is your attitude, your mindset. And, you know, I've heard countless nightmare stories with this, and then dozens and dozens of inspirational stories about this. So I wanted to definitely be on that inspirational side. I've already had a pouring of emails and even packages of people that have read our newspaper article or whatever, and, you know, about their stories about, you know, their 14-year-old and he survived and this and that. And, you know, so I'm inspiring people and they're inspiring me, and that's, you know, that's the positive I'm taking out of this. So yeah, that's what this is. This, real quick, is a newer technology specifically for glioblastoma. I got a bunch of bandages with little inch ceramic electrodes or whatever that are connected to this big battery pack. I got to pretty much wear a minimum of 18 hours a day, but it shoots electronic magnetic fields through my brain that disrupt the creation of cancer cells.
So you're actually continual treatment just as you carry on your activities throughout the day.
Yep.
Wow. When what was it like? And we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but just to kind of complete this part of your story, but having to go through the initial treatments, you must have had to do chemo and radiation or what?
Yeah. Right out the gate, I was doing chemo and radiation, and that stuff is no joke. The chemo itself, I'm still on a cycle of chemo every 30 days. I take it for 5 days, a large dose every day for 5 days. Then I got 3 weeks off. I'll continue that for a while. But the radiation and the chemo, I mean, geez, I had so many different side effects. I mean, my whole body at one point was broken out in hives for a week, and I was itching. I mean, and I could go on and on, but yeah. I don't concentrate on that. I'm here. I'm moving forward.
You got through the most nightmarish part, and now are you actually working? Are you back at work?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've been working. That's for dang sure. And it's really, really amazing because, you know, once again, looking at the positive things is I had headaches every week for years before all this happened. And since I've had surgery, I have not had one headache except last night. And that was because of my abscess tooth.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, I mean, yeah, this year, like even my focus and everything, like, it definitely was affecting me because I've accomplished and got more done focused strategically this year than I have in the last three. And it's amazing.
Well, there's nothing to bring focus any more acutely than, a life-threatening situation like this. It puts everything in proper perspective, as you said.
Absolutely.
And so, and I know that the entire pizza community already knows about this, you know, has you constantly in their thoughts and prayers, and hopefully now even a larger community will, you know, keep you in their thoughts and prayers for a full recovery. And I love the fact that, you know, your goal is to be an inspiration to others. So, you know, thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Peter. And I give a lot of credit to, you know, those people that have, you know, Jeff, you know, you've been, you know, reaching out, touching base with me, and thank you, man. I love you. I appreciate all the kind words and prayers. So, and same with, I've just had a lot of that, and I give credit to all of that, why I'm where I'm at too. So.
Well, thank you. Thanks for bringing everyone else up to date on that. But let's talk a little bit now about your pizza journeys, because, you know, you had these parallel stories. You're, you know, of a similar generation, and you've gotten there in slightly different ways. You mentioned earlier that you worked for a long time at Cloverleaf, which is part of that sort of original Detroit pizza story, which is now, you know, tipped over nationally. So were you like a lifelong pizza guy? I mean, did you start out as a kid and stay? Have you always been in pizza, or did you have something else going before you got into that?
Yeah, no, I
My phone does that all the time, and it only rings when I'm on the air. You know, it never rings when I'm standing by doing something else.
Yeah.
But we're on Zoom, so it's so everybody understands that. So, you know, don't worry about it.
Sure. Okay. So, the question I believe was, you know, did I start as a kid with Cloverleaf, or, you know, where was my beginning in the pizza business, basically?
Yeah.
So 14, my first job was at a party store called Vineyards. And not knowing, you know, they did sell pizza there, and they actually ordered the dough from Cloverleaf. And so I was making pizzas there with Cloverleaf dough and really had no clue and, you know, didn't know nothing about it. And then fast forward later on, it was the summer of 1995. I believe I was 18 years old. So 4 years later, and I, you know, from that period of time, I had all kinds of jobs. I worked for my uncle as a tile helper. I worked at a cherry, like Jeff, you know, I had multiple jobs as a teenager. But I was looking for a summer job, walked into a carryout and delivery place called Cloverleaf, which actually they opened after the Barn restaurant burnt down, and they left one of their managers there whose name was Sean Grafstein to run the place, or he actually owned it and everything. So, you know, Sean was working. I walked in, and because he had a he was hiring, had a sign outside, and he basically said, you know, can I start tomorrow? I'm like, sure. So I came in, and, you know, I started as a pizza delivery driver in 1995 at that location. It was about a year, and, you know, Sean was very burnt out. He had a family at home, you know, four kids working 7 days a week. Like, we all know, you know, how the business can be very demanding on you. You know, I told him, you know, hey, you know, I can do some of this stuff, you know, I can take care of Sundays, you take Sundays off. And, you know, so he made me assistant manager, whatever. He started taking Sundays off. That went for another year. So I was there for 2 years. And then he started talking about selling the place. And, you know, I'm 19 or something. And I really, you know, I'm not thinking I'm a candidate and, you know, anything like that. But, you know, I casually mentioned it to my mother one day, you know, that Sean's thinking about selling the pizzeria, and she didn't say nothing. But about 2 months later, she was a waitress at a restaurant, and she called me on one of her breaks saying, Sean, you know, you mentioned Sean was selling the place, and she'd come home and be all stressed out and just really did not like her job. But she said, you ever think about going into business with each other? And is Sean, you know, still talking about selling the place? You know, where I come from, you know, I never had money. I, you know, grew up in Detroit, not good part of Detroit till about third grade. You know, it's neither here or there, but I was the minority. I mean, there was two other white kids in my school, and, you know, I had all kinds of, you know, problems there. And my parents sent me to live with my grandpa in fourth grade. But where I was going with that, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, with the pizzeria, my mom, you know, mentioned that, where I was getting at is we didn't have money set aside or anything. So my mom pretty much, you know, we decided, okay, well, let's flirt with the idea. And we worked out a deal with him so that we would have to come up with so much down and, you know, make payments on the rest. So my mom, you know, remortgaged her house. We got the money. We got the pizzeria. Another whole long story that is not going to be going into right now, but the day we got it, I was unable to be a part of it for about a month. And my mom did not have any experience, so she had a crash course in pizza with just, you know, the employees that were existing there. Yeah. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy that, you know, at that time, I've definitely grown, but, you know, I could, you know, no one else could do ovens, you know, because I did them the best. You know, I had an invisible line that you couldn't cross at, you know, that young 19, 20 year old age or whatever. And it was really challenging that first month. And my mom thought we were going to lose the business. One takeaway, you know, Keith Pilak, an old employee, you know, she was crying in back, and she said, listen, you know, because she was afraid of, you know, ruining the business and losing all the customers. And he said, listen, you know, we'll lose some customers, but we'll get them back, because whatever. So anyways, that was how we got the pizzeria. I got back on board, and right out the gate, the first 2 years, we pretty much doubled business because we had fresh energy, you know, a lot of, you know, ideas and stuff. So things went well. And then after that, you know, it was probably, you know, I'll just fast forward to like probably about 2005, because after the first couple of years, it just stayed where we were at. We were, you know, we weren't growing. We were where we were at. And so about 2005, you know, I came to the point where, you know, I just kind of checked myself and said, you know, I never took business class. I've always had an entrepreneur spirit. You know, I was always doing things to try to, you know, hustle, make money, whatever. But I made a pact to myself and several people that have passed away that I will continue to grow and learn until I die from that day on. So from that point, I started going to the pizza industry events. Actually, 2005 was my first one in Chicago, Pizza Expo. And, you know, I started hiring consultants, taking classes, reading books. I was just a sponge for, like, you know, the next 5 years. And you know, there's a lot of good books I read, but my big thing takeaway out of that transition period was, you know, what they say is instead of having the business own you, you know, learn how to own the business. because before that, you know, pretty much I was, you know, the business owned me. And so, you know, and the transition isn't quick. So, you know, multiple years it took for me to finally get a grip on, you know, running the business rather than running me. But so I go to Expo, I see this competition. You know, I went to some other ones, 2006 or something. And I started seeing these competitions and I'm like, you know, that'll be really fun or something if I enter a competition. So, you know, it took me to 2009, actually, when I first competed in, it was North American Pizza Ice Cream Show in Columbus.
Yeah.
I went there 2009. So 3 hours from home, 3.5 hours from Detroit. You know, I get there, there's probably, you know, 60, 70 competitors there. And I'm looking around and I'm the only one with a rectangle pizza, you know, with the cheese spread to the side and sauce on top. And this was where my fire and passion really began for this style of pizza. Yeah. Because at the time, you know, coming from Detroit, I mean, at the time, I mean, we were Murder City, you know, Kwame Kilpatrick, you can watch his American Greed episode. I mean, there's just so much negativity surrounding our city. But, you know, to me, this style of pizza, square with sauce on top, caramelized cheese, was everywhere. You can go to the mom and pop shop. You can go to a chain. You can go to, you know, the bakery or whatever. So right. For me, that was pizza.
Right.
I didn't understand it was completely secret to, you know, everyone outside our region.
You didn't know about it.
So, you know, in that competition, I ended up winning first place, which, you know, even before I won, I had this, like I said, this passion to really get this style on the map. You know, I'm like, we got this pizza that obviously no one knows about. And to me, it's like so unique, so special. And, you know, I watch a History Channel on New York style or Chicago. And I'm like, man, Detroit has a better story. It's more unique, this, that. Yeah. So my whole thoughts during that little time frame were, you know, I need to get this culinary masterpiece that originated from our city that has, you know, some positivity going and share, you know, get it on the map. So my thoughts at the time were, let's compete more. You know, that brought attention to it. So I started competing some more, you know, won a decent amount of awards. Fast forward, you know, everyone kept on saying, you got to go to Vegas, the International Pizza Challenge. It's the biggest one. You know, so I ended up going in 2012. Won first place in my category, and then the blind box competition, you know, I won that. So, you know, was crowned World Pizza Champion Maker of the Year. And from that point, you know, that was obviously the biggest competition I won. So, you know, as you read in Tony's book, he got calls right away from people, what's this Detroit thing? And, you know, and it really did get a lot of attention. But, you know, right after that, it was still like, you know, man, number one, you know, I didn't get where I thought I did from 2005 or 2009 to 2012, like just by competing. So I wanted to like plant seeds and build an army of people that knew how to do this style authentically, because I did start traveling and I started realizing when I would ask people, have you heard of Detroit style pizza? You know, they would mention Little Caesars or Jets or make crack funny jokes about our city. And that really, you know, once again, just fuel to the fire. So it's like, okay, I need to teach people, you know, in our country was my first, you know, thoughts, you know, how to do this right. So that in 10 years, you know, when I ask people, they'll know Detroit style as much as they know New York and Chicago.
Right.
And that was my goal, to get this style as recognized as those two styles. And this was before, you know, Roman style and Neapolitan, all of those things really, you know, start taking off. Like nowadays, it was really like, you know, in my mind, the big three, Chicago, New York, and Detroit. But no one knew Detroit. So I started putting together a program to train people, thinking I could go around the country, train people how to do this right, because, you know, I've been involved with the originals, you know, and I wanted to make sure that when I ask someone in 10 years in California, do you know what an authentic Detroit style pizza is? They're not telling me Little Caesars or Jets. And night and day difference pizzas when you compare like a lot of the generic versions to an authentic version. And so then, you know, right out the gate, I started getting inquiries from Thailand, South Korea, you know, so the vision became much bigger very quickly for me than I originally expected. Once again, more fuel to the fire and, you know, kind of fast forward, you know, here we are. I truly believe we're still nowhere near critical mass, but it's a huge opportunity right now in the next few years, I think, for a lot of people.
It's at the tipping point now, I think, for sure. And, you know, and hearing the story, the journey and how much, you know, energy you put in. I found that in talking to a lot of people over the last few weeks in these interviews is that 2005 seemed to be a very important, almost magical year for a lot of people in the pizza industry. It's when many people either discovered the expos and the shows for the first time, started sharing knowledge and realized they weren't just out there sort of lone wolves doing their own thing, but that there was this whole community and network and tribe of fellow pizza lovers who were willing to share business knowledge and craft knowledge. And it sounds like you kind of grabbed that wave around the same time. So that was, and we'll come back to your story and how it kind of evolved into the Detroit Pizza Company. Jeff, does your story sort of parallel that in terms of the timetable, or did you come into it a little later?
I came in a little bit after Sean. I guess I'll go through it real quick. Growing up in the suburbs of Detroit, I was just eating pizza, and it was like, hey, on Friday night, do you want round or square? I never even heard of Detroit-style pizza.
Yeah, right.
Detroit-style pizza, we just called it square. Yeah. It always gets square. So there's a pizzeria there's a Jets around the corner from where I grew up, and then there's our local one down the street. So we would flip-flop in between those all the time. And then fast-forwarding to after college when I moved to Telluride. I was working in a pizzeria. I worked in a pizzeria. I was a camp counselor. I was a server at a restaurant. And I was a ski boot fitter, and I tuned skis. And at the pizzeria, I was always fascinated with, hey, I want to learn how to make pizza, but the owner would not train me to make pizza. I was on the dishwasher and the grill and the fryer.
Paying your dues.
Right. So that even got me more interested in, hey, I want to learn this. So after about a year and a half, I said, okay, we're going to train you to make pizza. So I started to learn how to make pizza. The pizzeria was average, and it was like a New York style or American style pizza. And that was the only style there. And then soon after that, one of the business partners had started an ice cream shop in Telluride, and he was selling his share of that pizzeria. So I scrounged up some money. I borrowed it from like five different people, got some loans and stuff. And I bought into that pizzeria. About 6 months later, we changed the name of it and moved it to Main Street, which created Brown Dog Pizza.
I see. And then Brown Dog became sort of this iconic pilgrimage for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, not just the past few years, actually, but this was way back in like 2004. When we first started it, and we were in a different spot than we are now. We were actually across the street. And the only reason we got the business started, I was like 25 at the time, was because the landlord of the space, it was a previous restaurant. He didn't have to do anything to it. And they gave us this great deal on rent. Yeah. And they were like, there's no way that we can fail. So we took the 18-month lease. That's how we started Brown Dog Pizza. And at the time, it was just American pizza, and it was really more of a sports bar.
Yeah.
It was more of a drinking place. The food was not that popular. But we were one of the places where you
were able to use it almost like your laboratory to perfect your particular version of pizza at that point.
Yes, kind of. But at the time, I was more into skiing and just kind of and making the place work. Into like developing the pizza.
Right. Remember, it hadn't happened yet. The whole fascination nationally with pizza as the thing, you know, hadn't quite yet happened. You were part of, you know, you were on that same sort of parallel path of coming.
We were like kind of successful, but like we definitely weren't known for our pizza.
Let me just stop you here for a second. When we come back, we're going to have you actually show us we'll continue the story of the evolution of your pie. And then you'll show us, you know, how you do it. And how you do it not only in Telluride but now in Denver, and we'll hear again sort of from 2005 to the breakthrough to the current day.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, makers of specialty cheese from Switzerland, crafted with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere in the United States. But that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach Cave Age cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmiusa.com. That's emmiusa.com.
Welcome back to Pizza Talk. I'm here with Sean Randazzo, Jeff Smokovich. We're talking all about Detroit-style pizza. These guys are the, you know, the I would call the current reigning champion, brand ambassadors of this style, champions in their own right and in competitions of making it. And we've been here, we heard in part one, a little bit of their story, the lead up to it. Jeff was just filling us in on sort of his ramp up to through Brown Dog to from a just an everyday sort of New York style pizza place and bar and sports bar to little by little inching up to creating his own signature version of Detroit style, which is similar but different than Sean's. And Sean is kind of like, he's been with it for years and years and sort of at the, really at one of the mother houses, I think Cloverleaf really is always referenced, I think, in like these top, if people say, you know, if you look up top Detroit style pizza places, Cloverleaf is always one of the ones listed. And so that sort of takes you all the way back to the roots of, in the 1940s, I guess, of the origins with, was it Gus Guerra who started all that? Was that at Buddy's? Is that where that all began?
Yep, 1946.
And Cloverleaf grew out of Buddy's, right?
Yeah, 1953, they sold a Buddy's to two Jimmy's, and that's when they went to, at the time, it was East Detroit, not East Point, and they found a big white barn-looking bar called Cloverleaf, and they purchased that, and that's how that began. It was a very Irish community there, so.
So is the style that was made there and what you currently make kind of pretty much a continuation of that lineage that began way back at the beginning?
Yeah, what we do is stick to the script specifically from the source, you know, starting with Gus Guerra and some of the other originals that have branched off. You know, they probably did some things a little different as well, but, you know, we really just want to stick to authenticity and tradition, and yeah, we continue to do things the same way. We don't get me wrong, I mean, like the fresh and parbaked, I mean, we've played around and did some testing and everything, but ultimately, you know, we want to, you know, stick with what we do.
And you mentioned this in the last episode, Sean, that a lot of people know of Detroit pizza, if they're not from Detroit, through maybe one of the first companies to branch out from Detroit, Jets. Is Jets one of those early models that then did franchise, or isn't it different from the style of the Detroit style that you do?
Completely different animal. The way it's structured, the dough hydration, everything. It's just night and day a different product. Really quick input. It's kind of funny because the store that I started at, the carryout and delivery from Sean Grafstein, he actually had one of the brothers, Eugene, or one of the Eugene Jet or something. I don't know. One of the Jet brothers working at that location before they went and opened Jets and Warren. So, you know, Jack and, you know, the Cloverleaf people have always, you know, and I'm neither here or there, I'm not in that conversation, but always had thought that, you know, they basically just, you know, took what they could from, you know, what they got there and opened Jets. But just a little interesting tidbit.
It is. I think people, the more that people get into it, the more they want to hear the whole history and story. And of course, a lot of it is on the internet. You can read those backstories, and especially the stories, the legendary stories about the pans, the blue pans. In fact, Jeff, one of your Denver restaurants are called Blue Pan, right?
Yeah, named after the blue steel pan. Yep.
The blue steel exactly. Pans. Yeah. So, you know, so since we talked a lot about it in the first episode, let's do some making this time. Jeff, if you could take us through your process, and Sean and I will just keep lobbing questions at you along the way.
Sure. Yeah. I'm going to put one in the oven right now so we can kind of stage it so you guys can see the whole thing come out. So we're putting one in the oven, and that will be the final bake. We're running our ovens at, like, they're electric ovens. So we have the top and the bottom heat. And they're about, we've run 575 to 600
really
on the top and the bottom. Yeah, so this is going to bake really fast. So backing up to the start of how we do our Detroit style is this is the par bake here. So this has been rising, and you guys can see these ones behind me. These are all rising, and they're about ready to go in for the par bake. As soon as we're done here, the guys are going to come back in and par bake them.
How long do they rise for, Jeff?
It depends, you know, it's all about the temperature of the kitchen. So they came in at like 7 a.m. this morning, and they probably got them in the pans by about 8. And so it's like 2 to 3 hours. In the summer, it's a lot faster. Now, you know, and they're not right next to the ovens, and the ovens are on too. So it's much warmer over there.
So it's unlike New York style pizza, which is just shaped and baked. These are like raising bread dough. You've got a couple hours of fermentation.
Right. And, you know, we'll do emergency ones in the middle of the day or even at night, too, when we're like, oh, we're going to run out at like 7 or 8 o'clock. And we could do it in 30 minutes. Not the exact product that we're looking for, but I don't think the customer notices as much. But, you know, as the pizza maker, you notice little thing that's wrong with it. So the par bake is here. This one's ready.
So we'll see when it comes out what it looks like after it's par baked. It'll probably start to brown up a little. Yeah.
And I have the fat in the pan that we use to grease it up is vegetable shortening for the par bake. So for our par bake, you know, everyone does everything different, and they come out with a Detroit style pizza.
I'm just going to keep throwing questions at you as they come up, because I'm trying to think of the questions that the viewers might have. Is do you use vegetable shortening as your shortening because it gives it holds on to the pan better than, say, liquid oil?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it grabs the dough. So we don't have a lot of that snap back.
Could you use butter as well?
No, just the vegetable shortening. Okay. And then this is another thing that we do. I'm doing the aged white cheddar around the edge right now. And this also helps us. One, it gives this caramelized cheese that everyone flips out about. And this is the most popular part of the signature item, in my opinion. Yeah. So this helps the dough stay to the edge for us, and we don't get that separation when the dough bakes in the oven. So it kind of creates like almost this like glue. So now it's ready to go in the oven.
Okay. So that goes on before the par bake. Okay.
Yeah. So now we're par baking at like, we're par baking in the morning at 450 degrees.
It's going to be like 450.
Yeah. Par bake to lower temp. However, if we're doing that emergency par bake, the ovens are already cranked up, so we can par bake at 600 if we need to.
I think Sean has a question for you.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, and, you know, this is a question I don't think I've ever asked you, but, I've always wondered, like, what led you to go par bake, and did you ever try fresh? And also with the cheese blend, I know that, you know, white cheddar started getting used early in this, and I don't know, you know, exactly where that came from, but any input on that I think would be awesome, because, you know, originally I don't know any originals that use white cheddar, and my thoughts, and, you know, I could be wrong, but my thoughts were, you know, it's very hard to find, or was out west, and if you found it, it was $8 a pound. So, you know, white cheddar has similar specs, kind of. It melts really good. It doesn't, like mozzarella, it turns black, you know, it's got a nice color. But what, if you could just, you know, share that, like, what led you to, and did you start that right out the gate, or did something kind of, you know, lead you in that direction?
Yeah, so it was all trial and error. And I grew up in Detroit on the fresh baked dough right out of the oven. So for me, and I don't tell many people this, and that, you know, now everyone's going to hear it, but if I make a pizza for myself, if I do a pizza for myself, I like the fresh baked dough. However, when I was testing it in Telluride, and I was testing it for years before I put it on the menu, tons of trial and error. And I would go back and forth between the raw and the par bake, and I still do. And I just did another test last month with some friends that came over and had a pizza oven at my house. And I didn't tell them I was doing raw or par bake. And it's close to 10 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. They always pick my par bake pizza.
Really interesting. I will tell you, when I teach people, like, I cover par bake and stuff, but I usually tell them, you know, only result into that if they're having problems managing their proofing process and all that. And, you know, your pizza, though, I've had a lot of par bakes. For me, like, we even tested 2 weeks, 3 stores wide when we had 3 locations, because we were having, you know, issues with the people on board, because, you know, managing the hundreds of, you know, pounds of dough is very difficult when you got all those pans and humidity and different temperatures every day. So, you know, we thought we'd give it a shot. And, you know, there's a lot of cool tips that have evolved over the years with par baking. I forgot his name, but he, one guy I met, you know, he covers it and holds the moisture in, because the biggest problem I have seen with par bakes, and we've done it for events where they're going to eat it right away because it's awesome. And yours, you know, you have a very good par baked pizza from every ones I've tried. But You know, the integrity, what I've noticed is, you know, it loses a lot of moisture. So the fresh dough, you know, when we use and people order carry out and delivery, you know, and they reheat it the next day, it's like same as it was the day before. Like with the par bake, what I noticed, it like dries out completely, you know, gets hard. I didn't see that in your pizza so much, but is that an issue at all?
Yes. And especially in Denver too, where we're at, you know, a mile high, the elevation here, and then in Telluride, we're even higher at almost 8,500 feet. So yeah, we need to be very protective of our dough and the par bake. So as soon as it comes out of the oven, it gets the lid right on it. And then it holds the moisture in it.
I agree with Sean. Very important. When I tasted your par bake at Pizza Expo, which is the first time I had your version, my assumption always was that the par bake, you always would lose something to, and it would be drier tasting and less creamy. But yours retained that creamy character. And I thought, wow, if you can pull this off, then it kind of changed my thinking about the possibilities.
Yeah, and then there's ways to do it for next day too. And, you know, I've been testing 2, 3, 4, 5 days of par bake that are old. And, you know, I'm almost preferring now the second day or third day par bake if it's stored properly.
Uh-huh.
But yes, that moisture thing is the major deal. And so this is a par bake that we did yesterday. And you can kind of see the bottom.
So you're only getting a little, just the beginning, a light gold, but not a lot, not a rich gold yet.
Right. And I'm going to re-grease the pan too when I go back in, and I'm going to re-grease it. I like to re-grease it the second time with extra virgin olive oil. So now I'm going to get a really nice crisp on the bottom. So this procedure is very, very intense and long. And when I have new guys come into the kitchen, they're like, what are you doing?
Right.
Like, crazy. You have too many steps to get your final pizza.
You have to have like the Bible there that people have to read and say, you must follow this by the letter of the law or it's not going to work.
Right.
I'll tell you, when we tested it for the 2 weeks with the 3 locations, Jeff, my whole goal was, you know, to not only get the issues we had with managing the proofing process fixed, but, you know, just, you know, this, like, we stored them for 2-3 days, tested that too. And I agree, like the second day, you know, it was good. But, you know, with all of that said, you know, I definitely, you know, we were calling customers that we gave them the par bake and we'd tell them, you know, do you mind if we called you later or call us and, you know, give us feedback because we made a change. We pulled the plug on it because I thought it was going to save us a lot of money and labor as well. But like to touch on your point, man, it ended up being more labor, and we were even having people come in after, you know, we were closed to do 3 stores worth of par bakes. And, you know, the par bakes are awesome for our big events and everything because, you know, it sets the dough perfect and, you know, you're ready to go and they're eating it right away. So.
Right. Yeah. So, and then back to the cheese thing too, the aged white cheddar. And I'm pretty sure it's not a Detroit thing. And I know it's not a Detroit thing around the pizzerias that I grew up in. But we were trying to take the caramelized cheese to a different level. And I got this idea from Thea 313. They started doing it right away. So I tested it out, and it's more flavor for the caramelized cheese. So we use 3 cheeses for the, caramelized cheese and on the pizza, but specifically around the edge is the aged white cheddar, then the brick and the mozzarella.
Interesting. So we'll talk about those cheeses in a second. But Sean, going back to you, is the traditional version 100% brick cheese, or is it a blend of brick cheese, Wisconsin brick, with something else?
Well, it depends which original you're talking about. I think Buddy's at one time was almost all brick cheese. I think they put Parmesan cheese in it too or something, But other than that, it's usually a brick cheese blend. So, you know, for us, we've just stuck to the script that we've always used, and that was a low moisture mozzarella and a brick cheese blend. But, you know, when I train and go out there, like, we test around with different cheese blends, and, you know, I'm a really big fan of like a Monterey Jack brick and mozzarella blend.
I never heard of brick cheese until I discovered Detroit style pizza. And it maybe it's because the Detroit pizzerias were buying up all the brick cheese. I don't know. But after I tasted it for the first time, I fell in love with it. I thought, how could this cheese not be more well-known and more popular because it's got such a unique, complex, buttery flavor? Okay, Jeff, we got to bounce back to you. What do you got?
I tried to time it, and I have another one that I could put in, but it baked so fast, and I started.
Yeah, no, we don't want to lose you.
It's like 5 minutes. So I'll put another one in, but this one just came out. So this is This is a par bake from yesterday.
So the decant oil, on the rebake, you use liquid oil, you use olive oil. On the par bake, you use the shortening.
Right. Which, you know, when we have like 100 tickets on the line, I don't know if that always happens.
Yeah.
They pop the par bake out.
Best case scenario. But,
yeah. So
when you finished that pizza, the one that came out, you had your cheese on it. Did you put that sauce on before or after the bake?
I did it before. And I like to do it before, and we have it, the sauce is already warm on the pizza line. But the par bake already has that structural integrity. So putting more, and we put probably heavy sauce on it compared to other pizzerias. But because of the par bake, it doesn't deflate the pizza at all. So we're able to put it on. We can put our 10 ounces of cheese, which we do, on this 10x14. And then it's about 5 ounces of pizza sauce is on here, which is quite a bit. And our pizza sauce is pretty thick too.
Yeah.
And then topping. So, you know, but everyone's doing it different. And then we all come out with like a pizza looking similar to this.
do you sell it by the pie or by the by the square?
No, we just do full pies. We used to do slices and that pre-pandemic, and now we're just doing
whole pies.
Full pies. Yeah. Yeah.
So that one coming
out. And now I'm working on, now this is the final part, is chiseling it out of the pan here.
Yeah, can you hold it up to the camera when you pop it?
Sure. Yeah, let's see if I can get it.
Or hold the camera down to the pan, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we've gone through a lot of different ways to get it out of the pan. I personally like this. This is like a putty knife, and this is what we've been using for like the past.
That's what I use at home too. It works good. I don't know.
Yeah, it's got a lot of strike to it.
What do you use, Sean?
For pans or
to get them out of the pan at the end?
Oh, to get them out of the pan, just a spatula flipper and gripper slips right out of the pan. Yeah, I noticed the Lloyds. You know, a lot of people are scraping them out and chiseling them. You got to get the authentic steel seasoned pans. I'm just putting that out there.
Okay.
They fly right out. We had issues in the past with flaking seasoning, and the maintenance of them was super hard. But last August, we developed and launched a new manufacturing seasoning process that eliminates all of that garbage that people dealt with. So
blue steel really stands up to the brutality of the process.
We have pans 40 years old in our rotation.
You probably have some of Buddy's original pans that he walked out of the factory with.
Some from Cloverleaf for sure. That I know that.
All right, so here it comes out of the pan.
Yeah, right. So soon as I was able to get that chisel, the cheese around it, you can see how oiled it is still in the pan. It pops right out. We're not getting any sticking in this area. It's more around the caramelized cheese, and I haven't figured out exactly. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. That one came out pretty easily. I didn't have to chisel it that much. And I'm pretty. I don't know. I think it may be from the HVAC shutter. But obviously, the first thing a pizza maker always does is you look at the bottom of it.
Yeah.
Check out the bottom and make
the undercrust,
sure it's safe.
Yeah.
And we got a nice crust on the bottom of it. Nice and
that's,
brown.
To me, one of the distinguishing characteristics of this style of pizza is that sort of, I call it a toffee-like shatter that you get, like hot buttered toast, when you bite into that piece of pizza. And the undercrust just is like the star almost.
Yeah, and so this is a par bake that I put in like, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 minutes ago, and this one's ready. And if you want to, we were talking about the dryness of it too, because that's always something that we're watching all the time. So let me just pop this one out real quick. Although we don't take it out, we would let it steam in here, put the lid on it, and then store it for the day for service. But you'll see the moisture on the bottom of it when I take it out. You can see that there's still the shortening and the oil on it.
Yeah,
it's basically steaming in that, and then we put that metal lid on it too. And you know, they're everyone's doing their par bake. A lot of people do it differently. The one guy that Sean was talking about, he par bakes with a lid on top of it. Keeps the lid on and par bake, so it's really steaming in there. But I find we get enough moisture in here with that, and then putting the lid right on it.
Well, I think it's cool that there's so many different ways people are feeling their way into the process. But also that you don't, in your par bake, you really don't need to take it to a super brown caramel point because you're going to get that on the rebake, it looks like.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So this is like, our par bake, I would say, is probably like, it's like 70%, 60 to 70% baked here. But yeah, it's still really white, and it's definitely not brown at all on the bottom.
But it's
set.
We get
that from, right. We have that strength too, but right now it's really soft in here. But
yeah.
Over the course of the day, when it settles for a little bit, it's going to, yeah. Even if I made this right now, I would still be able to put the sauce on top. However, this one that I just made is going to hold up a lot better than the fresh one. So like I said, we've been testing how long can we get our par bakes to last and how can we store them properly to do that. Taking them out of the pan, wrapping them in plastic is a really long process. However, we're able to use them if we wanted to. We don't actually use them in the restaurant. This is just stuff that I've been messing around with days later and still come out with a really great pizza. And like I said, in my opinion, sometimes better than the one that's that day.
So you got a nice cell structure, a big open cell structure in there. And a cool caramelization on the bottom, a little Frico cheese crust around the edge from the cheddar, specifically the cheddar. Are you allowed to say what your three cheese blend is? What are the cheeses you use in the top?
Oh yeah,
cheese?
Sure. Yeah, I mean we're using the aged white cheddar, and then we do brick and mozzarella. But the aged white cheddar is only around the edge on the bar bake here, and then in the middle we're doing a 70% mozzarella, 60 to 70% whole milk mozzarella that we shred here. And then we shred the brick too, which is another 30 or 40% brick.
So you use the shred, and do you also, Sean, in yours? And by the way, we're going to come back in a future episode with Sean walking us through his process as well, so we can see the differences. But we won't have time today for that. But Sean, when you put your topping cheeses on, do you use shredded or do you use cubes, or what's your method for the tops?
Definitely use shred and a thicker shred. We've used cube just here and there. And what I like about using a thicker shred is, one, it doesn't lose its moisture when it's baking. If it's a really thin shred, you're going to, have a lot of brown and it's not going to be stretchy. So the thicker the shred, the better. And not only that, one of the cool things about this style of pizza is the caramelized crown around the edge. And in order to get like a real, jagged edge or something, if you use cube cheese, it just, it's more straight. If you've got thick shredded cheese, you get a nice jagged crown there.
Like Jeff got on his,
I think one important thing too that the new Detroit style pizza makers are trying to figure out, and the main question I always get is, what's your guys' dough weight? Because like, you could create a pizza that looks like this, with like, if you don't make it properly, with like double or 50% more dough, but we don't want a doughy, thick, heavy pizza. We're always trying, how can we get a lower dough weight, but still keep the same sidewall and the same structure that we have here. So when you bite into it, it's like, oh my God, this tastes like, it's very airy and it's very soft.
You said that's only 10 ounces of dough in that pan, right?
No, 10 ounces of cheese.
How much dough?
Yeah. So this is the 10 by 14, so 140 square inches of pizza, and it's 17 and a half ounces of dough.
Okay.
I was going to say about the crown, Jeff, you've seen he did that cheese around the edge. Like some people, they don't know that, and they just par-bake the thing, and it separates from the pan, and then you got this sloppy, edge falling all over. So, that's good tip there.
So here's what it looks like. Okay. Backing up again, I'm all over the place. Sorry, but I wanted to show you guys this too, because this is before it's going in the oven. So you can see that we have our sauce on it in the two strips, which is an authentic Detroit way to do it. However, like some pizzas, if we have more toppings on it, we'll put the sauce under the cheese. This one just happens to have the cup and char pepperoni and the Italian sauces, which we use it raw and pinch it on top.
That looks awesome.
And then this is oven, and this is at almost at 600 degrees, and it's like, it's fast. So our final bake is like 7-8 minutes.
So that's good. And that's another reason, I guess, that par bake is useful in terms of throughput. When you have a busy day, you can't have someone waiting 20 minutes necessarily, or else the lines are going to go out around the block and down the ski slopes. We're going to come back and have Sean walk us through his, and let Jeff fire questions at him while he's doing his version. But Jeff, thank you so much for taking us through all that.
Yeah.
I'm wishing I could just reach through the screen and grab a slice because it's looking really, really good.
Yeah, I'm going to eat some right now for breakfast.
Sean, you're here at the sort of mother house of Detroit style. You're in Detroit. You're going to show us how you do it there. And also maybe we'll get to learn a little bit more about some of the other products that you sell besides pizza, how you help people in the Detroit style community equip up for, you know, for doing what they're doing around the country. But what do you got for us today?
Well, what we have is a margarita in the D. It's our spin on a margarita pizza, Detroit style, and it's topped with fresh basil, sliced tomatoes, red onions, fresh garlic, and sea salt, and obviously our sauce.
So it's a Detroit style pizza, but it's a margarita pizza, but in the Detroit style mode.
Absolutely. Yep, our spin of it.
Cool. Well, let's have it.
It's a very popular vegetarian option here, but we'll start with the beginning. I mean, I know we went into the history of this style last episode, but the real quick breakdown on this style of pizza: it was introduced in 1946 back at Six and Conan by a gentleman named Gus Guerra at Buddy's Rendezvous. The story behind that is shortly after World War II, people started coming back from the war, bringing European taste. Bars started adding fish and chips, pizza, and things like that. Gus wanted to do something a little bit different at his place. And we're in the Motor City here, so a lot of auto shop workers would come in and frequent his place. At the time, it was a blind pig during Prohibition. There's a couple guys, the story is told, that came in from the shop one day, and, they seen Gus playing around with his wife's Sicilian, grandmother's Sicilian dough recipe, which this dough is a descendant of a Sicilian dough. And, these auto shop guys said, hey, we use these little square pans in the auto shop. Why don't we bring some in? Long story short, he made, pressed out the dough, put pepperoni on the dough, cheese, sauce, 1946, put it in the oven, Detroit-style pizza was born. And I won't go into the whole, all the originals, but, with that said, it kind of spun out to four originals, and that would be Buddy's. Gus eventually sold Buddy's, went to East Detroit, opened Cloverleaf. Between that, Louis was working with Gus at Buddy's and went to Shields. And worked there for a while before some things happened, and then he went and opened Louis, and then you have Shields. So basically it's, Buddy's, Cloverleaf, Louis, and Shields are the originals. And when we're talking about everything I'm doing today, just like Tony G, respecting the craft, we're going to stick to authenticity. That's what we do here. And drinking fish. Well, there's lots of creative options with this style. It lends itself as an amazing culinary palate. We're going to stick to the script here and go over, the things that make this style authentic and other things like that. So,
okay. Sean, before you start, I'm going to mention that Jeff, you're going to jump in whenever you have some questions since you have your own take on it, and you're from Detroit as well, so you're connected to that origin, but you've kind of, as you moved away from the area, added your own spin. So I know you're going to have some questions for Sean, so feel free to just throw them in whenever you have them. And Sean, before you get going, can you just say one more thing about that steel pan, that blue steel pan that you've got? How did Gus know that pan was going to work for pizza? I mean, those pans were used to hold nuts and bolts in the auto shops, right?
Yeah. To answer that question, I don't know how he knew it would work, but he obviously made it work. And, since then, this pan here made of steel, seasoned, fair version is like this. Real quick history on the pan, but first I did want to say I love your shirt, Jeff. It's awesome. And then with Jeff, when we get into the other things that he does different, there's reasons for his rise behind his reason too, and we'll go in a little deep on that when we get to those points. But the pan, originally was made at Dover Parkersburg, I think, was the company in West Virginia. Originally made them. They supplied auto shops, oil change plate, whatever, a lot of different places use these. I even have some people in the scientific field and like labs and chemicals and stuff. They use these pans for certain things. But the pan's been used since 1946. It's made of steel. It went until about, I want to say, I'm not 100% exactly, but maybe 2009, 2010. Dover Parkersburg, it's one of the two, but they sold their pan division to Beer Hens, a garbage can maker. And they moved production to Mexico. During that period, there was about a year where there was no steel pans. It was in the Free Press, Detroit News, Detroit-style pizza makers scrambled to find pizza pans. So during that time, we have already, you know, established supplying pizzerias and people we trained with pans. So, you know, we too were in a crunch. We actually, at the time, were opening another location. So we were in desperate need of pans, and everyone was. So we kind of first went to try to make our own pan and got quotes and all this. And then me and a local vendor, Roselli's, were about to buy all the equipment from Mexico. But when they were being produced in Mexico, the reason why they stopped, they used thinner steel. The pans were garbage. We still have thousands in warehouse that the season wasn't sticking to. Long story short, that production stopped again. And that's when, luckily, before then, I started reaching out to other companies like Lloyd's, Allied Metal, Chicago, all these different pan companies. And Lloyd's, when there was the void, it really showed an interest and already had something going. So, you know, I worked with them for a while until we got back to our steel pans. Kind of fast forward, so I'm not spending so much time on this. Currently, you know, we're having these pans made here in Michigan. We have an amazing seasoning process that really has solved some issues with the old pans. Like this bear pan here, as you can see, it's super shiny and silver. Yeah, it's coated in mineral oil to protect it from oxidizing, like right now. But, you know, you have to wash it, and you have such a very limited time to dry it off because all the oil's off it, and it will oxidize or rust because it's bare steel. So, you know, you got to dry it and then season it very quick. So, you know, we don't really recommend this for people that don't really know what they're doing, but it is pretty simple. I mean, you just basically clean it off, put a very thin coat of canola, vegetable oil, corn oil on it. We recommend canola. And you bake the oil on there multiple times to create a coating and a release. And with that said, you know, we do have the seasoned version as well, which has a little bit more rough surface, which this one, you season it and don't put enough coats on and it comes in contact with water, you lose season very, very fast. We're not seeing any of this, and we launched these in August with this new pan, so it's awesome. No flaking, no chipping of seasoning, which was a huge, you know, downfall. No one wants a black piece of thing in their dough. So
if our viewers who are watching want to get a hold of pans like that, can they write to you and get them directly from you?
Yeah, DetroitStylePizza.com is where we have all of our products, our mixes, our pans, and all of our services. So that's the pan.
Thank you.
We're gonna start from the bottom up, basically. So we're starting with the pan, oiling the pan. You know, once you have a pan, the first time you ever use one of our seasoned pans, you're gonna wanna oil it pretty heavily the first time. And you may get a first initial stick around by the cheese. You know, you get it out one time, good, and then get any debris out of the pan, pre-oil it, do it, you are just freaking, you're good to go. You know, every time it'll just continue getting better. And as with each use, just like fine wine, you know, these continue to improve.
Yeah.
They slide right out, but we're gonna start with the dough. When it comes to the dough, what we're using here in our, what we use at our pizzerias, and we're actually at our pizzeria in St. Clair Shores, Detroit style pizza. It's our commercial dough mixes here at our third concept, Palazzo de Pizza. But what consists of the dough is basically we got two different kind of types of flour. We use a patent baker's flour, which is one of the purest parts of the flour kernel, the inner part of the kernel, and baker's patent flour. And then we also use a small percentage of semolina. We use a little sugar, a little salt, and we use instant dry yeast instead of active dry yeast. With that said, I do have some dough balls here that were made yesterday. I'm going to touch on how we use fresh dough and kind of the fork in the road with your options to ferment the dough. First of all, like I said in the beginning, I'm sticking to, authenticity. None of the original places, you know, do for cold fermentation, this, that. When I train people, there's several forks in the road I do like to cover, like the, you know, 24, 40-hour cold fermentation, or also, you know, we talk about par bake or using fresh dough. So with the dough here in our concepts, we use fresh dough. So we make it every morning. We portion it out. We press it. You know, I got some dough balls here I'll talk about and portion out in a second and talk about that. But basically, when we mix it, I'll talk about mixing for a minute. You know, we do it in different mixers. So if you're using a planetary mixer, you know, basically it's 1 minute. You get all the ingredients gathered together. You know, then we move it up to two. And then it's anywhere about like 3 minutes just to kind of get what we call an octopus head going. It's kind of just a ball that forms. The hydration level of it is 70%, well, our mix is actually 71% hydrated based on the instructions with the style of pizza. And I am going to stop on the dough real quick just to cover like what we kind of talked about, five characteristics of an authentic Detroit style pizza. One okay. being the dough being 70% hydrated or more. So what that does for the dough is it creates that really airy, soft, you know, gassy inside, but yet a super crunchy outside because the water content of it. And in baker's percentages, you know, that it's the weight of the flour versus everything else. So 70% or higher on the water content is what's usually typically done with the style of pizza. So mixing the dough, I'm jumping all over, but we went through second phase on a planetary mixer. On the third, really what you're looking for in any mixer on the third, and it could be on a planetary, it could be another 4 or 5 minutes, and we actually like to whip it pretty good. So we put it on speed 3 on like a Hobart. And then what you're looking for is, you know, after 4 minutes or something, stop it. You're obviously looking for it to clean up the bowl, come into a ball, even though it's super wet and sticky, it still should do that. Yeah. Then, you know, once it does that and you start hearing some slapping of the bowl if you're walking away, that's a good time to check it. And, you know, I'm talking about commercial here, but I also want to touch on residential. Same thing with the little KitchenAid mixer or something. You know, these kind of apply. You're going to do 1 minute to get it together, 2 for a little bit. Depending on your mixer, you may just want to keep it on 2 for a while and not go any higher, or not 2, but a medium speed or something.
Right.
Or super high. But the final product, the dough, you know, it's done. A few things. Number one, it should still have kind of like a color to it, not pale white. It should have a little khaki color to it. If it's really pale, what I've noticed is, you know, something went wrong. It could be too hot of water. It could be too much water, whatever else. And usually on the second phase of mixing, you look at those things. If it doesn't get an octopus head and it's leveled out and just is not coming together at all.
Yeah.
Three things we look at. Number one, if anything's stuck to the bottom, we like to put the water in first just to kind of prevent anything from kind of sticking.
Right.
And then second would be obviously maybe your thermometer wasn't calibrated right and maybe the water was super hot and it just, you know, it got things too hot so it's leveling out because the warmth isn't, you know, because the colder it is, the more it'll pull together. And then too much water or something else could have went wrong. But those right. are the things you look at. So what you're looking for in the final product is being able to pull the dough up out of the mixing bowl and about 6 to 8, maybe even 10, even 12 inches, wiggle it back and forth without it breaking for elasticity. That's telling you that the gluten structure in the dough has formed enough to where, you know, it's not going to be flat. And what this does, obviously, is it's going to hold in that gas that forms a lot better with that gluten structure tight and that elasticity. If you have dough, like what I notice a lot of people email, there are beginners at this, you know, with our residential mixes and stuff at home, I get emails saying that, you know, it never really pulled together like the video. It's super sticky, hard to work with. And 9 times out of 10, it's just a matter of mixing it a little bit longer.
Uh-huh.
Or if you do mix it a little longer and it's still not pulling together, you know, maybe there's a little too much water or whatever. Just throw a little bit more flour in there and then you'll see it start pulling together at
right.
home. You know, so that's
no,
that.
You can fix it. If it's not working right, you can still fix it. Don't give up on it.
Absolutely. I think when people start putting their hands in it and it sticks to their hands and it's all over the place, they're like, it's all wrong. But I would recommend just get it off your hands, put some oil on your hands. Another good tip would be take that dough, you know, if it's not a whole bunch or even if you're doing dough balls, and fold it in your hand with the oil a little bit. Even though it may be a little loose, it's going to start getting, I mean, you're just basically kneading it and building
yeah.
that food structure.
Gotcha.
So, you know, going back to mixing with the water temp, we do use instant dry yeast. We do recommend, and it does fluctuate from winter to summer and humidity. I mean, you know, making dough here and going to Jeff and making dough, it's going to be a complete different animal. You know, I've been up in Denver and I've worked with people and a whole different ball game. Not only with humidity, but the elevation and all that. So the point I'm getting at is, you know, you can't have a perfect, especially in a commercial setting. I mean, home's a little bit more manageable, but like, for example, in winter, we temp our water at 95 degrees because it's a little cooler and drier in here, and we want to get that yeast activating to some point so that we
yeah.
can rise and go and not waiting forever. And then in the summer, if it's really, you know, hot, we obviously, based on our proofing, managing the proofing process and everything, we might take the temperature of the water down to even like 80 degrees. So, you know, there could
yeah.
be a 10-15 degree fluctuation there.
Sure.
So once we get the dough mixed and done, you know, what we do is, and I'll kind of touch on residential and commercial kind of really quick, but we, for commercial, we use bus tubs. We put 20 pounds in each bus tub of oil. We have a bus tub with about 4 ounces of oil in it, and we do not put oil in our recipe, if you caught, didn't catch that. And we fold the oil, we let it rest for a little bit so it relaxes because it's kind of really tight after mixing. And another thing to mention too, on the third phase, I am just trying to give whatever I can here, but on the third phase of mixing the dough, if it doesn't seem to be pulling all together really good, another little tip would be to just let it rest for about 10 minutes in the bowl and auto-lease and just, you know, kind of let everything sit. Put it back on, you'll notice everything will start collecting and forming together a lot better.
Right.
So that's that. Once we get the dough done, we move it into, like I said, oil bus tubs. We let it rest. If I was at home, I would just form it into a dough ball. I have some dough balls here, or 8x10. We do a 9.5 to 10 ounces in our 8x10 pans. We do 17.5 to 18 ounces in our 10x14 pans. Wow. So once the dough is resting in the oil bus tub for about 10-15 minutes, we go and we basically fold that big batch of dough into the oil. You know, I tell my people, like, try to do it about 12 times at least. It's just a bulk portion of kneading the dough and working the oil in there. And then we let it rest another 15 minutes before portioning at our dough station. So, and then residential, basically we just take the dough balls, portion them. If we're using them the same day, we'll just put some oil on them. We'll have them out at room temperature till we're let them rest a little bit before we're ready to portion them in the pan. If we're going to, you know, make a few of them at home, you can ball them up. You can put them in the fridge for a 24, 48 hour cold fermentation. You can freeze them. The only thing I'm going to mention is once you put a dough, any dough, in the cooler or freezer, just keep in mind that when you pull it out, it is going to take a lot longer for it to even get to room temperature, right, which is where we start with fresh dough. So, yeah, and since we're talking about that, like, an optimal time frame from the time you have put your portion of your pizza in your dough in the pan, fully pressed it out, it's proofing, from that point where it's fully pressed out to when it's about a third way up the pan and ready to use or put away, ideally, you're looking at an hour and a half. Now, you know, that's like the standard to look at when you're trying to figure out how to manage your temps and, you know, everything else that you got going on with managing your roofing process. So, with that said, you know, once the dough is in the ball, we bring it to our table, we start portioning it in pans, and, you know, I'll talk about dough balls we have here. So we use fresh dough. So we go straight in that tub. We start dropping it in the pans, and then we give it, like, 5 presses. We go through the whole batch, which, you know, right now we got probably, like, 150 pans here. We got Joe right behind the computer here pressing out, our partner Joe Mano. And he's going to press them all out fully and then put a top on them. They're going to sit there every 15 minutes, half hour. We're going to check it. We're really looking for it to rise about a third way up. In the past, we used to say halfway up the pan, but once we, you know, we're working with people, they call and say they're going out and stuff, because cover them, you put them in the cooler, they're still going to rise in a big stack because that heat's trapped in there. So we kind of just recommend the third way up the pan. Once they're a third way up the pan, at that point, you're able to, you know, in a commercial setting, we leave some out, and based on volume, the rest we put in the cooler, and just take them out to get to room temperature based on volume of, you know, business. And at home, if we were to go ahead and start making it, we would obviously just press it out in the pan, let it sit. In a house, I'm going to tell you, an hour and a half is hard to accomplish to get a third way up the pan, unless you can find a really warm spot in your house.
Right.
What I like to do, especially when I got the oven preheating, is putting the pans of dough that I'm using kind of like by the oven, because it's got some heat coming off of it. But still, you're looking for about a third way up the pan. At that point, you're ready to start making the pizza. So, you know, I got some pans here. I'm just going to go ahead and
show you how you do it. Yeah.
But, you know, they've already been oiled.
Yeah.
So you can tell, super, super thin coat. There's no excess oil in here. You know, we really, if we had more oil, it would be hard to press out. It'd keep sliding. There's really no reason for it. It comes out super nice and crispy. So, an important thing with the dough, like, especially I see people when they come in and come training or take our classes, they have this instinct to, when they grab a dough ball, they want to just start playing with it or re-doughballing it up. When we take this, like, I want to be as fragile as possible. This has already been out for, like, honestly, about an hour and a half, our dough balls. Before I go on that, these dough balls, we use fresh dough. We do make about a dozen small and large dough balls. We use them for backup. So for us, if it's in the middle of a rush and we check our levels of pizza and we're running low because we had a couple huge orders, you know, Joe might tell Ryan to go grab the dough balls and start dropping them because it's going to take an hour and a half before they're even ready, close to ready. So, and also if we almost run out of dough today, we'll have some dough balls to throw in pans right away to get them going right first thing in the morning.
Jeff, we've been watching Sean talk about his method and the dough that he makes, the 70% hydration, and we talked a little bit about pans and everything else. And obviously you came out of that same, you know, sort of community. Do you have any thoughts about some of the things you saw that Sean was doing and how it impacted what you do?
Yeah, I knew a little bit about how Sean did it, but it's really fascinating to me how polar opposite are the two methods that we have, that we do. And then the end game is, you know, the pizza looks very similar in the end. Yeah. So really cool to see how Sean's doing it and then compare it to how I do it. And I've had Sean's pizza numerous times in the past, and it's delicious. I love it. So, you know, going back to the pan thing too, you know, Sean uses that style pan. I use a different kind of pan. However, like, I get questions all the time from people, well, I don't have a Detroit style pan. Can we just use any pan that we have in our house just to mess around with Detroit style pizza? And or a different oven or a different dough method and see how it comes out. And, you know, there's all these different ways that you can do Detroit style. And I don't think anyone really does it exactly the same. And we all come out with, a great pizza in the end, which is really cool.
So, which is like a testament to the power of pizza to rise above all of our individual quirks to give us something great, no matter how you kind of approach it.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I'm most jealous about that Sean has that he's able to do in Michigan and Detroit is the temperature there. Because in Denver, it is so dry here. In Telluride, it's even drier, the altitude. And then, you know, when I go in Detroit-style pizzerias in Detroit and they have that, you know, it's not always awesome when you're outside in the middle of the summer and you have the humidity. But when you're making pizzas and you get to have that humidity, and you don't have to cover, like, we have to instantly cover everything. The dough, as soon as it comes out of the mixer or as soon as you push it, you got to put the lid on it right away. Otherwise, it gets a skin right on top. But when I go in Detroit-style pizzerias, I'll see their pans. The neighborhood one that I grew up, they have their pans stacked on top of the oven with no lids on them all day long. So
yeah, it makes you know,
I would love to somehow insert humidity into the restaurants in Denver that I have.
It's kind of nice when we can say something positive about humidity. All right. Well, this is great. And Jeff, feel free to jump in as Sean, you know, takes us kind of through the rest of the process. My one comment was the difference between how much oil and how little oil Sean puts into his pans versus how much I put into my pans. And I always thought having a lot of oil in the bottom was kind of one of the secrets and the keys. But Sean, why don't you take it from here and tell us a little bit about where you go from this lightly oiled pan and then how you start to pan the dough up.
Sure thing. And Jeff, you know, had some...
Oh, we're having a little bit of a technical
what issue. I said, it depends where you are. There's so many different variables. So like, for example, for us in the winter, we're definitely covering our dough in the dead heat of the summer, especially if we got like, you know, 200 plus pans going. We may leave them unlidded just because we have enough humidity in the air. Not enough humidity, dry, you get a skin. I mean, there's just so much. But going back to pressing out this dough, we don't have too much time. So I'm going to throw a pizza in the oven right now so that it's ready before we're done, and then I'll come right back here.
Beautiful. We'll work it backwards, yeah.
And then, Sean, I have one question right off the bat when you're putting the pizza in. What the toppings that you have on it and then the cheese, how delicate do you need to be because of the raw dough when you're putting the cheese and toppings on not to have it too heavy or deflate it or, you know, how do you train your guys and yourself to be delicate with that?
That is a great question, and it is something that we have to be very careful of. So especially when our dough is fully proofed out here and not put back in the cooler and taken out, once you put it in the cooler and take it out, before it gets to room temperature, it obviously is more solid, and it's not as weak. But if we took it right from the stack after being a third way up the pan or further, brought it to the make line, number one, when we cheese it, we definitely don't just dump it on because it'll collapse. Just like where I'm about to talk when I'm pressing this out, we want to be as very fragile with the dough as possible. We don't want to drop the pan. So right. We just are very light-handed with topping, Jeff, and, build it, so that we're not putting pressure on the dough, especially when it's fresh like that. But normally most of our business is at, 5 to 8, and they have been in the cooler a little bit. We're able to take them out, and they still, have some firmness to them. But going right into the dough here, we have a 17.5. ounce dough ball. You can tell it's very, quite, if not super dense. And I'm not blowing it back up. A lot of people have a tendency, they want to start working the dough.
Yeah.
You want it as gradual as possible. What I recommend is just grabbing it like a triangle, using your four fingers, and place it into the pan like so, like that. And then from this point, 1, 2, 3, 4 presses, up to 6 presses, you're done. Go ahead and, any more time spent on pressing it out at that point, not only are you wasting time because it's, still a little tight, you're going to be pulling back, but you're also working whatever gas has already been in the dough out of the dough. So, you're kind of defeating the whole process of it resting and then proofing
it.
So my whole theory with pressing out the dough is you want to do it with the least amount of touches as possible. If 20 hand presses gets it to where it needs to be, you're great. If it takes, 30, 40, you need to work on that. We always, let people leave our classes and our training with the standard of a minute per pound hands-on. So if they go back and it's taking them 2 hours to do 60 pounds of dough hands-on only, well, then we know that more than likely, 9 times out of 10, they're pressing it out too much. And then also, working the dough too much. So that's a side note. I'm going to go ahead and just drop these other two in here. It's another large. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 presses, and then we for our small 8x10s, it's 9.5, 10 ounces. And same thing, we're not going to be very light with the dough. 3 presses there, cover them.
Sean, are you always using the dough balls, or do you use you said you go out of the bus tub too. Do you cut it and just throw it right into the pan, or do you always ball it up first?
Nope, we cut it, portion it into the pan, and then when we're done with all that, we usually have about 12 dough balls of each of dough left. We ball them up, and with that said, we put them in the cooler. We use them for backup. When we do train people, we do use those to give them an idea what the 24-hour cold fermentation is. I know you do bulk. For me, I always tell people, if you're doing that, I don't know if you remix the bulk thing, but I find it, if you make dough balls, they just are more consistent and more uniform where, if you have bulk, that inner part's going to be super hot and it's going to really, start expanding. And if you start grabbing from the outside, it's going to be a whole different dough than the center. But we do go through training and make them side by side. There is such a slight difference, but you will get more flavor, a little better aroma, a little drier. A little lighter, I should say, on 24, 48 hour, dough ball. But, a lot of people are coming in for commercial training and they look at, is this pizza worth or any different enough to add that whole extra process or step into the picture? Not so many have done that, but that's that. So we're making a margarita here, and I'm going to go ahead and make this. A couple things really quick about the toppings and cheese blend. Cheese blend, I'll talk about really quick. Brick cheese has been used for in the blend, or even buddies, I think, used straight brick for a while. The different cheeses you use in your blend are going to make, all the difference. The color of your caramelized brown, if you use straight mozzarella or like a mozzarella and just provolone, you're going to get a flat crust around it, brownish. One of my favorite blends that I ran into, traveling and just working with different blends and get people set up is like a 25% brick, 25% Monterey Jack, and 50% low moisture mozzarella. The low moisture mozzarella, if you use whole milk or something like that, it's just loose. The other two cheeses, like the brick, it's a softer cheese. It melts a little more creamier. Yeah. It has a buttery kind of flavor to it. And I don't know if maybe, you know, some people even came to Detroit at one point and, you know, tasted that butter and the cheese. And they're like, oh, man, they must put butter in the pan. But,
exactly.
You know, and all that stuff. But, you know, the cheese blend is important. Another thing is the shred. I'm a big fan of a very thick shred. You go too thin, it dries out on the pizza too quick. You don't get that nice cheese pull. Not only that, you use cube or a little cube. I like the way this large shredded cheese sticks to the pan, steel pans, and creates a really jagged, edged, authentic-looking crown on the pizza, where sometimes with cubes, it just kind of, it's a little bit more straight. But that's the cheese.
Sean, what's your opinion on the diced cheese that you see? I've seen a lot of Detroit-style pizzerias in Detroit. They'll use diced for some reason. I've tried it out. Not a huge fan of it, but
I was gonna say Louis. I know uses cube cheese, and you know, back to what I said, it's just I think you know, looking at their crust line, you'll see that it's more like you know, it's just a straight line rather than you see some nice Instagram pictures of a really you know, really cool jagged crown on these pizzas, and I think that is really really awesome and adds to the pizza. But yeah, my opinion is I'm not a fan of it. I'm a fan of thick shredded cheese. And okay. You know, with this whole pizza, the dough, the cheese, the toppings, let me go check on the pizza in the oven really quick.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's checking on that. You didn't mention anything about Parmesan in that blend, did you?
Nope, just for ours, what we do is we do a brick and low moisture mozzarella, just the two cheeses in ours. And I was talking about cheese. Oh, yeah, consistently even. So the style of pizza, the theory is everything's consistently even in the pan. The dough, you want consistently even. You're not working it up the edge. The cheese, you want it consistently even, but when I do that, I do want some of the shreds, you know, on the edge of the pan so we get a nice caramelized crown. Toppings, too, consistently even. You don't want, you know, vegetables thrown against the edge, but, you know, I notice when I start telling people that to avoid the edge of the half inch, then everything's in the middle. So,
yeah, right.
You know, I look at a pizza as art, and you know, I take care in making them. So, I look at the pizza on how it's going to be cut, the slices, and I kind of place my toppings like that. But with all that said, I am going to grab a pan that I had pressed out earlier here, and this was it actually did pop up pretty good.
Beautiful.
So I didn't think it would get to where it needed to go. But you can see it's about, you know, a third halfway up the pan, which is perfect. So what we would do here is from this point, we put a little dry oregano directly on the dough. So I'm going to spray this.
That's a nice trick. Yeah.
And then for cheese, 8x10 small, we use 6 ounces of cheese. For a large, we use 12. And like I said, if I was to just like dump this in the middle like this, this whole center would collapse. When the pizza bakes and comes out, obviously there's going to be no structure in the middle. It's going to be flat because it collapsed. So what I like to kind of do is just put a little bit in the middle first, just slightly spread it, and then I'm going to go ahead and go all the way around.
Sean, what percentage are you getting around the edges compared to the center for the cheese? About?
Really, it's just consistently.
Pretty even.
Once I get all the cheese on there, I just kind of fan it out. And like if I was to look at it, like I really don't put it up against the sides or anything. I mean, obviously you got some little, you know, strings that are already there. But once again, it's just consistently even. It's kind of what I do. Once again, I'm going to check on this pizza. I'm right back.
All right. We got pizza baking. We got a pizza making.
Yeah, one of the things about, you know, baking these pizzas, especially in commercial ovens like these deck ovens, which have traditionally been used to bake trick-style pizzas, there's hot spots, this, that, so you need someone with some kind of skill on them. And, like, right now, I'm going to turn it around. We're really busy. We don't turn every pizza around, but it's got probably another few minutes, but I'm just going to give it a little tour.
Okay.
What kind of ovens are you using there, Sean? They look like they look beautiful and antique-y ovens.
Yeah.
Like an old Baker's Pride or something.
They are actually 981 Blodgetts. And
Blodgetts,
yeah.
Actually came from the original Cloverleaf and are well owned. And the other ones we picked up in Rhode Island years ago. But yes, very old ovens, but they're like old cars. There's three things that can go wrong, and they make the most amazing Detroit-style pizza. On the ovens, real quick, we've tried so many different their ovens. Right now, we're still working with Hot Rocks to get everything where I'd like to see it, but you know, it's been a challenge to find any conveyor ovens that get where a deck oven will get.
Yeah.
Are you know, and there's these tips and tricks you can use, but traditionally deck ovens have been used for this style of pizza. We got some nice fresh basil here, so it's part of the team. We do put the basil on before we bake it. A lot of the fresh stuff like arugula, things like that, we like to put on after post bake. I'm a big fan of that. But with this pizza, it bakes really well. We just make sure we put it on first so the other toppings sit.
So being a classic margarita here, it's got to have basil and it's got to have tomatoes and cheese. Basically, those three things are all you really need for it to be a margarita. And then everything else is sort of a plus and a bonus.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that pizza should be coming out in just a minute here. We bake at 525 to 550 in the ovens. And, you know, a cheese pizza, pepperoni pizza, you might be looking at 8 or 9 minutes, and deluxe or multi-toppings, you're looking at 15, maybe 16, 17 minutes tops.
It's so interesting that for this margarita, instead of using sauce, you're using fresh tomatoes.
Yes, when it does come out, I will also add our sauce to it.
After it comes out, yeah. So are these plum tomatoes that you're using?
These are just Roma tomatoes here. We have different tomatoes in here, but just these right here that we use for our pizzas are the Roma. Little red onion. And this right here then goes in the oven like the one we have coming out.
Beautiful.
And I will be pulling that out right now.
So now we see what it looks like going in, and we're about to see what it looks like coming out and the transformation that takes place as a result of the oven.
Sean, what's the temperature that you're running your ovens at for that kind of bake?
So 525 is what we're kind of honed in at, but like in back, it's, you know, one corner it's 575, yeah, et cetera, but 525.
Is the same. What about Jeff? What do you set yours at?
For our final bake, we're at 600, and at one location we're using an electric, so it's even hotter with an electric with the top and bottom heat. The other location is a gas deck baker.
But you do a double bake, right? You par bake the dough first at a different temperature, like what, 450 or something like that?
Lower for the par bake, 450, and higher 600. Wow, that looks awesome, Sean.
Yeah, oh boy, yeah, that what a change, huh? Yeah, so you got that beautiful caramelization on the cheese.
And this slides right out of the pan.
Yeah.
And even though you didn't really emphasize the rim, the perimeter, you got a nice meltdown on the side and a little frico edge without having to do any kind of special, you know, prep for that.
So hopefully you guys can hear the crunch on this bad boy. At this point, and you notice that we cut the pizza before we sauce it. Some people do raisin stripes, this, that. The reason why we cut it before saucing is deliver, carry out is our main business. So you got sauce that falls in the cracks and it's sitting in the box for 15 minutes. Could create some, crust issues on the bottom. So with that, we're going to go ahead and sauce this.
All right.
Not done yet, almost.
This sauce is that sauce you keep warm. You keep it in a warmer. It's not cold sauce, right?
Exactly. It's we have it on the countertop in the warmer. We post sauce all of our pizzas. It's a world of a difference from putting it on before bake. The pizza way more consistently without all that moisture in the oven. And also, the big thing for me and the reason why we really, really went this route years ago was the taste. Pop completely different. Like if I was to bake this and pull it out, it seems like more like one taste. Like with this, I take a bite, I can taste the awesome sauce flavors. I can taste the different ingredients more independently. Yeah. And for me, that was a game changer that I said, we need to go to and test this with everyone. And hands down, everyone agreed that it was a way better product. So with that said, I'm going to ask if some of the people here, like my partner Joe, my daughter Harmony, and my wife Carrie, can come and maybe try a piece of this.
Yeah, try it. We'll vicariously enjoy it with you through the screen, but they can enjoy it on our behalf. But also, when they hold up the slices, hey, guys, if you could show us, like, the undercrust, too, a little bit, so everyone could see kind of all aspects of the pizza.
So hey. We actually put sea salt on top as well on this pizza. So
just break everything out, yeah.
You know, we got the pizza. I don't know if that's a good view, but.
That's a great view. Yeah. Pretty awesome, yeah.
Sean, the best part for me so far is that you have your whole family working in the pizzeria.
we'll let my wife take the first piece. Go for it. And they're going to always grab a corner. Just so you know.
I would. I always go for that corner, too.
I was actually joking yesterday that we should cut the larges and we get four pieces, too.
Right.
All right, let's do a pizza cheers and call this a...
I know everyone always likes to see that, but
We love to see the undercrust.
Yeah,
because that's where that crunch comes from. How's it taste, guys?
It must be really good. Nobody's talking. Yeah,
yeah, but clearly not their first time around the Detroit style pizza. That's for sure. But you guys have been making these for a long time in your family. Do you ever get tired of it? Do the family members ever get tired and say, no more pizza, Dad?
No, it's actually getting a lot more fun because we're making more at home with all this pandemic thing. It's like, now my son, he's 9, and I'm getting him to get involved and, cutting his own pizza at home and making his own, and I can see him taking pride in it. So it's really, really cool. And so to answer your question, no. I mean, for me personally, because of what I have going on with my health, I don't do many carbs at all. I do take a bite randomly here and there if I'm training, especially and need to. So I'm missing out, but we're definitely eating more pizza than ever before.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for, and this is really like has been a master class. We've had some little technical glitches with the Zoom things. So those of you who are watching, if you wanted to, fortunately, you can go back and replay certain parts to make sure you get all those steps, because there was an incredible amount of information given in these two segments. And we really appreciate it. What I love about this Detroit style, and this is true with, with the Sicilian and the focaccia style pan pizzas, is you get those textures. You get the crunchy undercrust, you get the great, crispy sides, and then you get the creamy, buttery crumb of the dough. And then on top of all that, you get cheese and sauce and all the other bonus, ingredients.
Oh, yeah.
But it really starts with that dough. Hey, we'd love to say hello to your wife. Would you mind introducing her to us?
Yes, this is my lovely wife, Carrie. She is a huge part of our
Hey, Carrie.
She does a lot of our prep, our dough, and...
Hi.
Great to see you. Again, I want to thank both of you and the whole family and the whole group, your partners, everybody, for allowing us to come into your, pizzeria to show us your method, your technique, sharing all this, because, as we know, this style is sweeping the country. Jeff in Denver, Sean in Detroit, and then everybody out, the outposts out there that are all sort of adding, I would say, momentum to this snowballing effect of Detroit-style pizza. For 60 years, it was like this great secret that only Detroit seemed to know about. They didn't even call it Detroit pizza, they called it pizza. And then now everybody wants it. So now we know how to do it. So, guys, thank you so much for spending as much time as you have with us on Pizza Talk. Thank all of you viewers for watching. And we will see you on the next episode of Pizza Talk. And hopefully we'll get you guys back for more master classes in Detroit style technique, and then maybe show some of the new developments, some of the new concepts you've come up with over the last few years as you've gone from the classics to sort of your personal versions. Okay, so guys, Jeff Smokovich, Sean Randazzo, Terry, thank you all for being with us, and we'll see you all next time.
Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/ Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Thanks for listening.